there are three parshas of Chumash that are chock full of mitzvah, chukim, and mishpatim, and similarly, they also are presented in a very indiscriminately scattered kind of form. That is to say, we don't see any seder in these parshas. I'm not going to attempt to do justice to that tonight. That would take many, many hours. But the three parshas are mishpatim. The second one is Kedoshim, and the third is Kisetze. You should be aware of these three parshas. What I would like to discuss is a fundamental yesod in Judaism, and that is exactly the value of Mishpatim. Let's begin. Take a look at the beginning of Mishpatim, and even the end of Yisrael, of Esi Pasha, presents us right away with a formidable challenge. If the Mamar Har Sinai, what does the Torah say? It's on page 177 in the red, white Chumash pagination. Parakal Pasuk Yutes. Torah says, "Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Kol Somal Bnei Yisrael, Atem Beisem Ki Min Hashamayim Dibarti Imachem. I spoke to you from above." And then we have an injunction against idolatry in Pasuk Chav. Lo Ta'asu Niti, Elohei Chesed, Elohei Zohar, Lo Ta'asu Lachem. And the last three psukim speak about halachas that are connected to a mizbeach. You should offer up your karbanos on the mizbeach, and then pasuk habeis. You should, when you build the mizbeach, lo tivne ezhen gozit. Metal should not be associated with the mizbeach. The mizbeach is designed to bring about shalom, and metal, of course, is associated with the sword. And the metallic implements are implements of war and bloodshed. And finally, the fact that the Torah ends Parshas Yisrael with the discussion of the Mizbeach would almost automatically lead us to one conclusion, namely that the next Parsha should be not Mishpatim, but rather which Parsha? Truma. Take a look at the beginning of Truma. What does Truma deal with? There are two Parshas, of course, that come about the Mishkan. One is Truma, that's on page 190, Perek Hafei. And right away, the Torah tells us an obligation to construct the Beis Hamikdash. Beginning of Tumah, Perek Hafei, Pasuk Ches. You see that? Oh, sorry. You have a different pagination.
226.
But in Perek Hafei, Pasuk Ches, thank you very much, Basu Limikdash V'Shachanti B'Socha. And then we have, of course, in Tumah, what essentially is found here? The Torah describes the Kelim of the Beis Hamikdash. Correct? First, the overall directive to build the Beis HaMikdash, and then the Aron, and subsequently the Kapores, and beyond that the Shulchan, the Menorah. And so it would seem that since Parsha Truma talks about the construction of the Mizbeach and the Beis HaMikdash, and the Torah ends Yisrael with the discussion of the Mizbeach, so what should really fall upon the heels of Yisrael? Parsha Truma. That would seem to be the logical connection. The Tzav, as you know, talks about Dikdei Kahuna, the garments worn by the Kohanim. And yet, what does the Torah do? The Torah decided to interrupt, to somehow interpose between Yisrael and Truma, and we have an entire parsha devoted to Mishpatim. It seems to be, as I said, very puzzled. The Gemara has increased us on that test. The Gemara actually points out that when the Jewish people committed themselves to the covenant, which is found in the parsha of the end of Mishpatim. You look in Perek Chav Dalet, in the end of Mishpatim, take a look in Perek Chav Dalet. Torah has a very striking parsha, beginning of Perek Chav Dalet. Page 187 in this pagination. Moshe Rabbeinu is told to ascend to Hashem, and then the Torah goes on to say, in Pasuk Gimel, Vayavo Moshe, Vayisaper Lo Meis Kol Divrei Hashem Meis Kol HaMishpatim. And what do the people say? Layan kolam kol echad ayomru, kol adrayim asher dibei Hashem, naaseh. We are committed to go ahead and carry out the Dvar Hashem. A bit after, Pasuk Dalet, Moshe Rabbeinu builds him his bath. There are 12 matzevos corresponding to the 12 shvatim. They offer up a shlomim, look at Pasuk Kei. And then in Pasuk Vav, we have, in effect, sprinkling of the dam that takes place. And finally, in Zion, Vayikach Sefer Abrits, Vayikrov Yosneon, Vayomru, Kol Asher Dibrei Hashem, Naaseh, V'Nishmor. So we have some sort of a covenant that takes place over here The only question is, when did this covenant take place? So Chazal, the Gemara says that Am Yisrael entered the Bris with three things: Mila, circumcision; Tevila, namely Tovah LeMikvah; and the third is Zrikas Adam. Zrikas Adam is found over here, the pasuk that I just read in Perek Avdalit. So that seems to be an integral part of the Bris that Klal Yisrael entered with Hashem at Har Sinai. But again, we have a problem, because suddenly the Torah actually took a bris that apparently, ostensibly, took place when at Har Sinai, and where does it place it? At the end of Mishpatim. Where does this bris belong, logically? At the end of, or the beginning of, Parshas Yisrael. And there's the Mamre Har Sinai. A second question that is something very puzzling. Here are the two questions. Question one, again, was, why did the Torah decide to enter, describing Mamre Har Sinai, the end of Parshas Yisrael? We have a discussion about the Mizbeach. The following Pasha should clearly be Truma, that deals with the building of the Mishkan and the Mizbeach. Question number two, the bris that's found in the other Mishpat that really belongs in Parshas Yisrael. What's it doing over here? So there's a Machlokes Tanoim. It happens to be also Machlokes Rashi and Ramban. On this Pasha in the other Mishpat, when did it happen? Before Matan Torah, after Matan Torah, according to one opinion, that everything is according to the chronological order, and this is after Matan Torah, because we have, generally we assume that the Torah is in order. So first we have Yisrael, Mamre Har Sinai, then we have the laws of Mishpatim, and then at the end of Mishpatim we have this bris that took place somehow after Matan Torah. So then, of course, the problem becomes even more pronounced. Why would Hashem interrupt Mamre Har Sinai, which is divided into two? We have Yisrael, the end of Mishpatim that talks about the bris, and in the middle, somehow, what do we have? Mishpatim. A whole series of laws that deal with Shomrim, as you know, Shomer Chinam, Shomer Sacham, Shoel, laws of Nezikin, basically, Baba Kama, Baba Tziyah, and Baba Asa. I found in Pasha Mishpatim, essentially, that's what you have over there. But why would that be placed before the conclusion of the bris with Am Yisrael, assuming that this bris is taking place after Matan Torah? So there's another opinion, of course, that the bris is out of order, and the bris took place actually before Matan Torah. Just to show you this idea, this notion, and you can actually see it. In general, you probably are aware, or should be aware, of the principle that actually Rashi often quotes. Look at Rashi in Perek Avdalit Pasuk Aleph, page 187. The Moshe Amar, the bris that the Torah describes in the Eruv Mishpatim, says Rashi, Pasha Zu Nemra, Kodem, Aseres HaDibros. That's why Rashi has no problem placing it before Aseres HaDibros chronologically, because it doesn't seem to make any sense to be placed over here. It belongs, when we commit ourselves, Nasa Nishma, then we can receive the Torah, Mamre Har Sinai. And Rashi is based on the principle that Rashi has throughout Tanakh, which is called Ein Mukdam, Mubarukah HaTorah, that we don't have to be concerned about the chronology of things, that Ein Mukdam, Mubarukah, the Ramban has much difficulty with this Rashi, or with this principle. The Ramban points out, you can't simply apply this principle helter-skelter. You can't simply do it, as Rav Salvezi would say, willy-nilly. You can't simply apply it across the board unless there's a compelling reason to do so. But Rashi seems to feel there is a compelling reason, and the compelling reason being what I explained to you, namely, that obviously this would seem to be more in place, more in sync with Mamre Har Sinai, and then Rashi understands it, that it's out of order, the Torah place at the end of Mishpatim, but it really belongs in the context of Mamre Har Sinai. So I want to just address the whole idea of Mishpatim. That's really where my interest tonight is, and perhaps share with you a number of things with reference to Mishpatim in general. You probably, since we're learning Sanhedrin this year, although we're not learning actually necessarily the Gemara's in the middle of Sanhedrin, I have the source of learning it with Jeremy Shlita, my Rebbe. So he and I have been able to, a little bit, discuss mitzvahs that relate to Bnei Noach. And what's very fascinating is that you probably are aware of this. There's a big machlokes of Rishonim. You heard the Shem Mitzvah Bnei Noach, undoubtedly. Also, it's on Heaven, the Rav, the Zion, the Ches, and Ches, all over there in the middle of Sanhedrin. And there's a list. Usually the list goes according to the Aleph Beis. You probably remember even some of that. Aleph is Eiv Rachai, and Beis is Birkas Hashem. Excellent. You're really into it. And it refers to blasphemy. And what about Gimel? Gila Rayos. And Dalet is Dina. That's what I'm interested in right now. Dalet is Dina. What does Dina refer to? So that quotes the Rambam Ramban, what Dinim refers to. The Dinim, the Ramban says in Vayishlach, he argues with the Rambam over there, because he has a very famous position. Dina means setting up a court system. That the non-Jews are also obligated to set up a court system, a judicial system, and in effect, what's included in that judicial system? The Rambam says, all the dinim of Hashem Mishpat. Namely, what's included in Hashem Mishpat? The dinim of Shomrim, Ones, Mefate, Nezikin, what else do you know? Chovim Chavero, Nava Vulova, Mechachamemkar. If you're interested in knowing about these matters, you should consult Rabbi Yifra Shlita, my Rebbe. Because he is learning Hashem Mishpat of Yaseder, that's what he does every morning. He's going in order. Following the Torah Shulchan Aruch. And the Ramban is of that opinion, that that's what we're talking about. And the Ramban actually assumes that more or less that's what we have. The same dinim that apply to Jews apply to non-Jews as well. And the Ramban indicates, I'm not going to go through the whole Ramban because it's not relevant to me right now. That's how he understands dinim. And that's what he writes over here in Parshas Vayishlach. And the Rambam disagrees. The Rambam has a different position about what exactly these dinim are, but I'm just noting the fact that there is a discussion among the Rishonim whether the dinim that we have are the same dinim that the non-Jewish world have. That's the Rambam's position, and the Rambam has a disagreement with that particular position. The reason why I say this is because in the davening every day we say the following, if you remember, Magid Barov the Yaakov, Ukov, Mishpatov the Israel. That sounds like who has Mishpatim? We do. Lo asachem lechogoy u'mishpatim v'alizdom. They don't have mishpatim. We have mishpatim and they do not have mishpatim. Hashem gave to Am Yisrael chukim mishpatim. He didn't do it to the Umas HaOlam. And then when mishpatim somehow express, if you will, a very close connection between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. And so, I just want to know, again, a Rashi that's found in the beginning of mishpatim. Look at the first Rashi of mishpatim. It's also very famous. Rashi comments on the Vav. V'eila mishpatim ha-shatas l'vayim. What does the Vav always imply? Some sort of a either that or a connection between what and what? That which is written here and that which precedes. Correct. So then what Rashi says, V'eila mosiv ha-rishonim. Ma rishonim mi-sinai, ha-veila mi-sinai. Rashi says, just like Mama ha-sinai, Asher HaDibros was given at Sinai, so too, mishpatim were also given at Sinai. And this Rashi reminds me of a Vatanura. I hope you don't mind. Batanura, the beginning of Pirkei Avos. You probably studied that, Batanura, I assume. In Pirkei Avos, you know, they have a rather lengthy... What's Pirkei Avos all about? How would you describe Pirkei Avos? In a nutshell. Ethics, excellent, very good. That's exactly what it is. Ethics means how one should behave. So the Batanura writes the following. I want to read his language, which I have down for myself. Omer Ani says the Batanura. It's not founded upon any mitzvah, like all the other masechtas in Mishnayos. But it's all what, as you said it beautifully, musarim, ethics. The Batura says exactly what you said. It's all ethics, ethical behavior. And many of the non-Jewish philosophers wrote many svarim. For example, you're familiar with Plato, Aristotle, they wrote on ethics. I imagine you probably studied a little bit. Plato and Aristotle and their ethics. For instance, I just studied the Torah, and then you can go ahead, if you wish, and go on to the Greek ethical system, which is obviously different than ours, and that's exactly what Rabbi Nuno wants to point out. He says, when they did that, which they did, what did they do it based on? The Rabbi Nuno writes that Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai includes not only the mitzvahs, but also includes what? Ethical behavior. How we should behave also comes from where? Comes from Sinai. Is divinely ordained. Mashen Kendi, have you ever read Aristotle's ethics or Plato, his ethics? It's all obviously human, man-made, coined by human beings, devised by human beings. It does not come to have any divine kind of origin. And that's what the Batanura first points this out. It's a very significant Batanura. So people make a mistake and they think that ethics is something that what? That everyone can make up. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. You're probably aware of the fact that today in hospitals, there's a very popular system of ethics which is called contextual ethics. I mean, ethics is defined by context. I'll tell you what I'm talking about. There's a very good book, I'm sure you will eventually encounter it, that is called Eichmann in Jerusalem. Eichmann in Jerusalem was written by a German sociologist, Hannah Arendt, and there she basically, Eichmann, you've heard of, he's a fellow who, shall we say, was a, how shall I describe it, a fiend, F-I-E-N-D, a Rasha Marusha. He was responsible for killing tens of thousands of Jews in the Holocaust in Shabbat. And anyway, she wrote a book defending him. How could you possibly defend Eichmann, such a fiend? So what does she answer? She said simply because he acted... I'm sorry? Exactly. He followed orders. You know, Yekis are very into doing things, Germans, in a very orderly fashion. And therefore, he was a Yeki. And he followed orders. Hitler, the Fuhrer, gave him orders to destroy the Aryan race and destroy Jews along the way as well. And he simply followed orders. So his ethics was a function of what the context, what Germany was all about. And therefore, he is not to be indicted, not to be condemned. On the contrary, he's to be praised. You know what happens if you were not around when the Eichmann trials took place here in Israel? I was around, and I was glued to the, shall we say, glued to these trials. A well-known prosecutor named Gideon Hausner, an Israeli prosecutor who literally prosecuted Eichmann, and then he was found guilty, and then you probably remember, or maybe are aware, of what happened to him, what they did. What was that? That's correct. So Eichmann essentially was, despite all his protestations, he was actually found guilty, clearly, what he did. And the reason why, because we have a totally different system of ethics. Our ethics is not based on context. What is it based on? An absolute system of ethics based on the Torah, which is relevant, doesn't make a difference. What era we live in? For example, there's no question that ISIS, you have undoubtedly read about these wonderful chaps. Those who are involved, they like to, they're very into beheading people. Seems to be their great symbol. They have great joy. And of course, they think what they're doing is totally ethical. Do you think they think it's not ethical?
They think
so. Of course they do. Unquestionably. And now do they think their behavior is ethical? But in general, people around the world, undoubtedly, whatever they do, they justify through their own ethical postulates and ethical principles, etc., etc. So the point of the Batadura, and apparently Rashi here, is telling us the same, namely, that do not be misled. Don't think that ethics is a function of context. Ethics is a function of whatever my morality happens to be, whatever I think, whatever I decide to go ahead and a system I create, that's incorrect. That is obviously a premise which is absolutely unconscionable, because with that premise, you can do anything. You can go ahead and kill people and behead people and destroy society and civilizations and all justified based on what? On ethics. But the ethics that we have, which is of the absolute nature, is Misinai. That's what Rashi says here. That's what the Rabbi Tanur says in Pirkei Avos. And that's why I believe that's exactly what the Yerushalayim had in mind. And they wanted to really stress this idea. So therefore, the same thing applies also to Mishpatim. Mishpatim also are man-made laws. Every society has laws. You understand very well. If society operates without laws, what happens? There will be chaos. Radak writes this about the Perush of Tanakh, but it's obvious, it's so elementary, my dear Watson, there's no need to articulate this idea. It's something which is so fundamental, so basic. And therefore, every society has laws, but the laws are man-made. The Chiddush of the Torah is that not only are Midos from Sinai, but Mishpatim are also from Sinai. How we interact with each other, laws of Shomrim, laws of Nezikim, laws of Onah, laws of Kabbalah, basically all Baba Kama, Baba Tzir, Baba Asra, has its origins at Sinai. And that's a very important yisod the Torah is trying to get across to us in this week's fashion. Rav Soloveitchik was very, he pointed out that for hundreds of years in Europe, the Shabbos of Mishpatim, which is this week's Shabbos, was the Shabbos of the Chevra Shas. Chevra Shas, the people who used to learn Shas. And every Mishpatim, they will make a Siyam. Dafka Mishpatim. You might ask, why Dafka Mishpatim? Why not some other Masechet? And the Rav pointed out as well, a Gemara in Barbasa. It says, Arotze Sheyachim, someone wants to get smart, Yasuk Nezikin. He should learn Baba Kaba, Baba Tzia, Barbasa. Masechetas that are not too popular in certain circles. I won't say where. But anyway, what's that heaven? For that matter, it's also part of Nezikin. Sheyachim Mitzah, Batorah, Godel, Men. What does that mean? So the Rav said over the following discussion that he had with his cousin, and the discussion was along the following lines. Young children, and I imagine you probably remember as well, when you start learning Gemara, usually what's the first Gemara you learn? Shall we say in classical circles? Correct. Usually they learn kimat 90% of the world. Okay, I'll give you 10%. 90% of the world begins in what masechta? Amitzia. Which parak? Amitzia. Did that ever trouble you? Those who are familiar with Amitzia, basically the whole parak deals with one issue, namely. That is the but what is the bulk of the parak talk about? Machlokes. Whether Yesh Lo Midas Have Yesh or Have Yesh. It's one kashya to the next. What in heaven's name would we spend? I don't know if you saw learning Gemara. Fifth grade, fourth grade, third grade, even out to school, kindergarten. First grade, I don't know. Correct, that's also true. The same question could be asked over there. Little children, based on the Medrash, Yavot Tahorim, Yisasku B'Tahorim. Little children who are Tahor, let them be Oseg with things that have to do with Tara. But did it ever trouble you why that's so? So the Rav had a discussion with his cousin, Moshe Feinstein, that's all, on this topic. So the Rav said he thought the reason was development. Because if you ever learn Yishtayim Edson or Elam Atzios, and you're into learning in a serious way, you'll realize that the sharpest verse adopted Bab Mitzia and Bab Kam and Bab Avasa. Yes, Hashem, I hope you'll come to that recognition in a little while. Svaras, you know what Svaras are?
Logic.
What?
Logic.
Those Gemaras are based on, of course, it has its own set of postulates, its own set of principles and logic, but the logic is impeccable. Impeccable. And most of the great Svaras that have been written on, shall we say, on Shas, have been written by Gedolim who spoke about these kinds of Svaras, such as, I imagine you heard of the shall we say, the Tzitz HaKoshen, and the Avodah Miluim, and the Shev Shmaitza. There's a famous story about Abchaim Shmuel Levitz. Abchaim Shmuel Levitz, they were traveling to Shanghai, Rosh Hashiva, the Rishi Yeshiva, they didn't have too many Svarim. And they're on the, shall we say, on the ship. It's a long voyage. And someone asked Abchaim Shmuel Levitz, they want to know where they are, latitude, longitude. Abu, help me! Where are we holding? He was busy reviewing the Sefer Shem Shmaitzah. He says, Mehalti Shmaitzah Gimel. He was in the middle of Shmaitzah Gimel. The whole Sefer Shem Shmaitzah, which you know by heart. So the Shem Shmaitzah is a gorgeous Sefer, and there are many other such Svarim that Dafka were written, and in order to develop the minds of young children, they learn Elam Mashiach and Baba Kama and things like that, Hakones, Neda Baruba, Prokham like that, correct? I assume that's what you did, the Salzburger family. Is that what you did? Probably every one of us, all of us, you know, one or two who somehow deviate from the course and learn brachas. But most of us actually, that's what we do. That's a minhag, it's a minhag Yisrael. Here at Eretz Yisrael, the practice is to take a young child, and as you mentioned, now they wrap him up in a talus and give him some honey. They want him to associate the Torah with sweetness, etc. Anyway, Rav Moshe Feinstein disagreed with the Rav and his cousin. He said, you know the reason why we teach Elam Matthias and our Kone Sevaruba? Because you know what these prophets talk about? People's property and people's persona, their bodies, and not to engage in the zikin, not to harm anyone. You know we want to sensitize a young child? Not to harm any other human being. And not to harm their property. And to be yashar, to be glatt, to be straight and honest. But the Rav was so taken by his cousin's explanation, the Rav told Rav Moshe, he's right. I thought it was a briska, and someone was not a briska in terms of the explanation, and you should remember that because Rav Moshe said it's unbelievable to be sensitive to other people's sensibilities and to their property, and Chas v'Shalom not to go ahead and in any way impinge or infringe. And so then, these are the laws of Mishpatim here, and they are found, and I was going to give you a number of examples, and maybe I shall towards the end, but I thought first I will share with you a number of, how shall I call them, vignettes. Little anecdotes that relate to this issue of Mishpatim that I'm very taken with. First I'll begin by telling you the following story. And this story to me is one of the unbelievable stories that I'm aware of. There was a great Talmud Chacham, his name was Rav Aaron Bax, in Europe. And he was a very, very well-known Talmud Chacham, but he wasn't a household name. Anyway, there was another Jew in Europe whose name was Rav Shraga Feivel Frank, who was a very wealthy person and was a very successful businessman. And he had actually some sons-in-law. He had sons-in-law who were some of the greatest rabbanim in Europe for the previous generation. And when he died, this Rav Shraga Feivel Frank, he left his wife with three unmarried daughters and told her on his deathbed she should use the unbelievable inheritance that she's going to receive to find the greatest Talmidei Chachamim as husbands for their daughters. That's what Rav Shraga Feivel Frank told his wife. Daughter number one of the three remaining daughters married Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. You may have heard of him. He was one of the greatest Rashi Yeshiva that ever lived. Also happened to be the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler Satzal. Just there, Chaga. He was a giant, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. He lives in Kletz, and later on came to Eretz Yisrael. Daughter number two married a massive Talmud Chacham named Rav Baruch Horowitz. The third daughter became engaged to this Rav Aaron Box, this fellow that I'm talking about. And one day Rav Box said to his scholar, "You know, your father had a big business, a tremendous factory. I would like to take a tour of the factory. I'd like to see exactly what your father, what he did." So when the mother-in-law heard that they took a tour of the factory, she says, "That's the person I was told who's such a big Talmud Chacham. I should take him as my son-in-law. He's interested in business, in factories, in money, in materialism. Goodbye, Shidduch." And she called up the Shidduch. She said, "I want Gedol Yisrael. I don't want businessmen." So who did that daughter marry? Rosh Shiva Slavodka and Moshe Mordechai Epstein. They have three brothers-in-law who are Gedol Yisrael, and this Rav Aaron Box is left by the wayside. So he went back to learn Slavodka. He became a massive Talmud Chacham at Rav Aaron Box. And when the position of Rosh Shiva Slavodka opened up, they offered it to him. Trust me, that's not a small position. He declined. He offered the position a second time, he declined. A third time, he declined. So finally, the Alter Slavodka, the great Rosh Shiva, said to him, "Why don't you want to become Rosh Shiva Slavodka Yeshiva? It's one of the most prestigious yeshivas in Europe." And he gave the following answer. "If I became Rosh Shiva," he said, "that widow will realize that she made the biggest mistake of her life. I mean, she could have had this great future Rosh Hashiva as a son-in-law. And why did she break the shidduch? Because she thought he wanted to become a business person. He was interested in material goods. I cannot hurt her feelings. I don't want to do that to a widow." And that's why he didn't become Rosh Hashiva as a son-in-law. You hear that? What would I do? Trust me, I'd be the Rosh Hashiva as a son-in-law. I didn't even know how to be that. And I would say, Max, let her eat her heart out for that silly mistake of breaking the shidduch. But he understood what the Torah says in this parasha. The Torah says, "Ko almana v'yasam lo sa'ana." Do not in any way hurt the feelings of a yasam or an almana. When I was in the Shia, Rav Soloveitchik, that's all. Most people in the Shia did not dare open up their mouth. That's the understatement of the year. There were a few individuals who spoke in the Shia about what it seems, that's all. Herschel Schechter, your brother, Chaim Arukin. You know Yisrael, they spoke in the Shia. But all of us, including myself and the us, quiet, the Havdil as a church mouse. Didn't open up my mouth. Because usually if you open up your mouth, how shall we describe the reaction of Rav Soloveitchik in 98% of the cases? You were essentially excoriated. That's being polite. There were two gentlemen this year who always opened up their mouth. And they said the silliest things imaginable. And what happened? Rav Soloveitchik would hear them, and he would say, usually in Yiddish, "Zeh interessant, very interesting what you said. Wow," the other one he would say, "that's a very fine approach that you have." So we who knew what's going on in the Gemara, said, "What? These two guys are the silliest. Clearly, they're saying things that are absolutely unconscionable, irrational, incomprehensible, plain stupid." And Rabbi Soloveitchik says, "How interesting. What a fascinating approach that you have." And then what will he do? He take what they say and make Chiddush Torah out of them. They're the biggest Chiddush imaginable. We could not understand and have said, "What's going on there?" I would open up my mouth, and trust me, I'd be slaughtered. Slaughtered! And it would take me 6 months to recover with 7 psychiatrists and who knows what. These two, they can say whatever they want. I decided to investigate. There's got to be something going on over here. I discovered, took me a long time to discover, the two were Gerim Tzedek. They converted to Judaism. They were the authentic Gerim, and the Rav was concerned about the Chazal. B'shloshim b'shisha b'komos his hero Torah l'anas ager. God forbid you should in any way say anything to a ger, someone who became a Jew, who was formerly a non-Jew, now became a Jew, and all the, you can imagine the unbelievable courage it takes to become a Jew. Those of us who are living today certainly understand it. You know, we're surrounded by so many people who doesn't love us dearly. You may have noticed that. We're enveloped by love from all around, all over the world. The Secretary General of the United Nations. You're familiar with the number of his statements that he made in the last short while. And the Secretary of State, he just loves us. He loves us to such an extent, he wants to simply, I think the term in English is, we should, overwhelming love, overpowering love. Secretary of State. Mr. K, you're familiar with it. And the recent statement of the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., did you catch any of this? I don't know if you follow what's going on in the world. But they just love us dearly. And as you know, we're still the state of Israel in the Middle East is just surrounded by mighty Rabbi Mayuchu Kabbalah Sisa'adla. They love us so much, it's just no end. Okay, but why do I say this? So I discovered that these two were very exciting. And that's why I saw it, Jake, when it came to Yisomin, Almana, Yisomin, Tzedek, the Parsha Bishpatim, Paho, suddenly loomed large, and they could do nothing wrong and say nothing wrong. Whatever they said was Kedush Kadoshim, became literally the Holy of Holies. And that's an indication that shows you, again, something which is based on these Parshas here, Mishpatim, that we are right now about to read in Mitzvah Shem, this coming Shabbos. And I just want to perhaps, again, along the lines that I'm talking about, also refer to a number of other things that I found in Mishpatim, just to give you an example. The pasuk says here, Pasuk Mishpatim, I'll show it to you. What happens if you see the chamor of your enemy? Kisireh, chamor sonacha, roveitz tachas masao. The Torah says, you see the chamor of your enemy, that is crouching under a terrible burden. That the animal obviously has a massive burden on its shoulders, and the animal is about to collapse. The animal is about to literally, completely, almost be in the dust. So the Torah says, "V'chadalta mi'azov lo, azov tazov imo." Your obligation is to go out looking for Perek Chav Gimel Pasuk Kei. It's page 185. Perek Chav Gimel Pasuk Kei. So the Torah says, when you see the chamor of your enemy, what enemy are we talking about? The Gemara has an avi tzachim. The Gemara says, we're talking about, you see someone doing something which is inappropriate, and therefore, you are allowed to go ahead and hate him. Otherwise, can you hate another Jew? God forbid, chas v'sholom. You know, I hate another Jew. It's only on the very specific circumstance that we're talking about. So there's a tesepta that is called in Baba Tzia, and that one of the base. The Gemara says, there are two different types of situations. One is called Priko, one is called Tina. Namely, this Chamor obviously has a massive burden on its shoulders. So what are you supposed to do? Remove the burden, correct? What mitzvah is that called? That's called the mitzvah of Perika, taking off a burden. There's another mitzvah. You see someone trying to load a Chamor? That's a mitzvah called Tina. You're supposed to help them as well. What happens if I have the following situation? This is the Gemara in Baba Tzia. Oh, hey, Lifrog. If someone who's a friend of mine, he's involved in the process of perika. Perika means that he is removing an extra load that's on the whatever, the camel or whatever it may be, and then he's my friend, and then I have a Sunday, my enemy, Litom, I can help him load his animal. So the Gemara says, Mitzvah and Sunday, better help your enemy first. Why? They lock up and Tzitzel. In order to subdue your Yetzer Hara. Of course, the question is, if we're talking about someone who did something inappropriate, that's why he's a Sunday, what are we talking about? What's this Kriyas HaYetzer? Why do I have to, on the contrary, subdue my Yetzer? The Gemara says, it's a Mitzvah to hate that person. So, Tyson's right over there. Since you hate him, your friend will hate him, because as a result of that, he'll come to terrible sinner. And again, the example that that's mentioned over here, that in general, if a person wants to eliminate sin in his life, so the only way to do so is by doing what? By helping your, shall we say, your enemy, so to speak. Now, I have an enemy. Under certain circumstances, the Gemara says you can, but the only way you can overcome whatever sin you have is by, in effect, helping another person. This all comes out of the Pasha Mishpatim. Mishpatim is a Pasha that deals with sensitivity to other people's sensibilities. And that's really, I would say, almost the entire Pasha from beginning to end, and it has to be studied very, very carefully, because it has in it, as I said, all those elements that deal with that particular issue. I want to mention, since I'm talking about this particular issue, I want to mention a number of other items that are really connected to, shall we say, the Pasha Mishpatim. Honesty. Honesty is something which is very endemic. It's what it means to be an Orthodox Jew, an observant Jew. I'll read the Rabbeinu Bechaye writes in his Sefer, Kara Kemach, anyone who maintains a life committed to honesty and integrity, all his fields will be answered. And he has it, a proof from the Pasuk in Asherah. Karav Hashem l'chol karav, Hashem is close to all who call upon him. The Chalashay Kuru, only they call upon him with truth. Anyone who claims and who lives his life with integrity, there's no question that person Hashem will listen to his tefillos. So, among the stories that are told about Gedolei Yisrael, a famous story with the Chazon Ish, this is a very beautiful story. The Chazon Ish actually had a minyan in Bnei Brak of 10 people for mincha every day at his house. The minyan took place at 12:30. Once they were short of 10th person, and the clock was running, before the 10th man showed up, it was already 12:45. As they were beginning Ashrei, so the Chazon Ish's brother-in-law, his name was Ashmuel Grinder ben Zatzal, the big tzaddik, and the great Gadol, said to the Chazon Ish's brother-in-law, I have a 1 o'clock meeting with somebody. If I say it for mincha, I'll be late for the meeting. I'll keep the person waiting. What should I do? But I'm the 10th person. How would you pass me the Shiloh? Harry, what would you say? Not a simple question. On the one hand, you're the 10th man. On the other hand, you have a meeting that you set up with a person. The Chazon Ish said the following. Chazon Ish Paskin, coming late for a meeting is an act of deceit, of sheker. An honest person has to keep his appointment in a timely fashion. Better that the minyan not take place, then you should be involved in the sheker. Now basically, what are we doing? When we come late to an appointment, we're not only sending a message to the other person that his feelings don't mean anything to us, we are acting inappropriately to Hashem as well as our fellow men. What do you say, Ari, to this talk of Chazon Ish? I'll tell you what I said. Wasn't that he was going to miss mincha? Chazon Ish. But that minyan would not take place. Chazon Ish felt this was overriding factor for more important than davening mincha at that particular time with a minyan. The Chafetz Chaim writes in Shmiras Saloshes, and this is a story that I can really be made about. When I was a very young man, I was davening in a shul in the Bronx, New York, New York City, and there was a very chashuv rav in that shul. He had a big influence on my life. I mentioned him many times. I feel confused. He lost his family in the Holocaust. He remarried. Baruch Hashem, he was only to one son who has many children. So there's a hemshech of Doros, Baruch Hashem. It's a tremendous talmid chacham. And but he had a shul though, it was like a little shtibel. Mostly elderly people who were there. I brought the average age down to about 70 at that time. Anyway, so I was there before Bar Mitzvah. and he would say shiurim. He was a tremendous Abba Chacham. I didn't really appreciate the shiurim at that age, to be honest. But my father, Shalom, felt I should stay for the shiur, and I didn't. And unfortunately, what happened was is that mostly elderly people, Ben Azmanin, come home, he's a shiur bacher, come home, and they come into the shul, and he now sees the opportunity to say a shiur to people like you who are big Talmid Chachamim, big B'nai Torah, who understand, who have appreciation. And what happens? So these guys do one or two things. They take out big Gemaras, and they start learning whatever Gemaras they start learning while he's speaking, which gave him Khalif Sadas. And I chanted Khalif Sadas, gave him
weak money.
He sort of was basically totally not just offended, but he
lost train of thought.
Discouraged.
Good, thank you. Okay. Luckily you came. Not only discouraged, he was completely and totally almost a destroyed his feeling. He has a chance to speak to people. And the others, what do they do? They just left. They tell a story about a certain yeshiva that was Shiva. You know, people don't like to go to shiur, so don't you do it. We're quite familiar with it. Anyway, so the Rosh Hashiva is about to say a shiur kolali, and he's actually going up the stairs, and they're all running out of the smedish as quickly as they can, so they can avoid the shiur kolali. And so the Shiva, they didn't even know who he was, he says to them, quick, the Rosh Hashiva is about to say shiur, quicker. That's the situation today. And it's not a good situation, because obviously there are people who have feelings. I'll tell you another story, which also I think is related to Mishpatim. And this story is about Rabbi Yosef Segal, who's a Manchester Rosh Hashiva. He was known as the Chafetz Chaim of England. That's what he was called. And he was a tzaddik, unbelievable tzaddik, also especially honesty. He was once traveling into the city by train, and the conductor would come by and collect the fares and issue tickets to the passengers. And he began the trip, actually, in the second class economy section. But later on, he moved to the first class section, which had many seats available. And essentially, the passengers in his car decided to redefine the nature of second class. The noise was unbearable. He was trying to concentrate on his learning, wasn't really able to. And hoping the conductor would come to the first class section and collect the added fare, he turned to his sefer, and he learned for the rest of the trip. When he came to his destination, he realized the conductor didn't come by. He went to the station master to pay the difference in price. And despite being told that it was unnecessary, he insisted on paying the money. So as he left the booth, the station master said, "That man is one in a million." Someone once called the Dr. Kamenetsky Zatzal and asked if he could call the sick for Purim so he could spend the day with his family. Surely it's more appropriate to spend Simchas Purim with your family than to be working in an office. Rabbi Yaakov said, "It is also behechlet to call in sick if you're not sick." That's totally dishonest. These are the Gdol Yisrael that clearly learned Pasha Mishpatim and learned it, shall we say, incredibly well, and obviously absorbed it. Last night I was at a Levaya of one of the Gdolei Adorim, Rabbi Saul Belsky, there was some wonderful gentleman from the yeshiva who also attended Levaya, and he was a Talmud of Rabbi Kamenetsky, and also his honesty was absolutely impeccable. And just in general, Pasha Mishpatim really is all about honesty, and how one should be yashar in one's life, one should be glatt and straight, and one should really try one's best to be mekadesh Shem Shamayim, to go ahead and really akedesh Hashem. Recently they showed me, I don't have any access to anything, I'm completely clueless in the world of technology, I'm being honest. I don't know if it's a good thing or not a good thing, I don't know what your position on the matter is, but that's the way it is. So the Rabban showed me here 2 days ago a very fascinating video of a Orthodox Jew who is well known, and he happens to be a son of this Rabbi Belsky, Zechen Lebracha, and he was in Ireland, in the airport. And there were a whole group of American armed soldiers, American forces, American soldiers who happened to be in Ireland, and apparently they were clearly haggard after whatever particular mission they went on, I don't know exactly what it was, and they were looking to eat, and they brought with them, I guess, some, I don't know, maybe peanut butter sandwiches, I would say, I would describe it at that. And he saw them, and he's a person of means, of great means, and he all of a sudden decided to go ahead and treat them. I don't know how many swords there were, but he spent $20,000 and told them each one would go to the restaurant. They were obviously non-Jewish soldiers. Go to the restaurant and they'll pay $50 for each soldier. And then he proceeded to make the following speech. I heard part of it. He said, and it's clearly he looked pretty Jewish, tipped out, big kippah, white shirt, the whole business. And he said that I owe you a tremendous sense of gratitude of Hakaras HaTov. You are defending our country. Even abroad, you're defending our country. And there's no question, the gratitude I have to you is mind-boggling, tremendous gratitude I owe you, and therefore I want to go ahead and treat all of you, and that's what he did, at a very aristocratic restaurant. Each one got a $50 meal, $20,000 it cost him, and it was a Kiddush Hashem beyond belief. I grew up, and I'll finish with this, Avraham Soloveitchik, the son of Bracha, whom I adored. He was a model for me, a brother, a younger brother, Avraham Soloveitchik, in Chicago later on in his life. He used to sing the national anthem of the United States, the Slavs. Except he made one change in the Nusach. He sang, not in the national anthem of the United States, that he sang the Slavs, but the national anthem of the State of Israel. He sang, I'm coming to it. Correct. He sang, instead of Lios Am Choshi B'Artzeinu, he sang Lios Am Kodosh B'Artzeinu, not Am Choshi. So I went on to the Shiva, and I said, how can you change the Nusach? I was 13 years old. How can you change the Nusach? So he told me, he says, Avishai David, this was composed by someone who was not exactly for the most orthodox observant Jews in the world. Choshi! Choshi min ha-mitzis! I don't remember this. Choshi min ha-mitzis! Chas v'sholom. I'm Kodosh. But I said, how can we change the Nusach? I can teach them my very way. And he sang it with such a Islavos, both the national anthem. So I asked him, why do you sing the national anthem and not sing with such a Islavos? So he says, Hakaras HaTov. He came from Europe. And the Rabbi Shapain also called the United States government Malchus Shel Chesed. Look at the Chesed we did for the Jewish people. We developed, we emerged. Community, Baruch Hashem, was successful, flourished, prospered. All because of the United States government. We owe them Hakaras HaTov. That's what this fellow did. And it was a Kiddush Hashem, Elchad Dover, greater than this Kiddush Hashem that he did. That's what we have to do. We have to study Mishpatim in order to know how to be Mekadoshim Shamayim, how to act as Jews who are, shall we say, totally proper 1,000% and Yoshua, and Beis Hashem, with that Kiddush Hashem, no question, we'll be able to spread our wings in the widest imaginable way.